Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, it's Thursday. Hold on a second. I'll tell you the day in just one. Thank you, John Turner. I just never know what day it is. It's the 24th, and for radio, you should know that, of September. We're so happy to have Franz De Waal with us this hour. He's been here several times before. He's written a lot of books. He's the author most recently of The Age of Empathy, Nature's Lessons for a Kinder Society. He writes, apart from psychopaths, all humans are endowed with empathy, which is the capacity to be affected by the emotional states of others and to become part of their situation. It is an ancient capacity that evolved to help keep animal societies together. It is often ignored in political discourse, which loves to stress the benefits of competition, but nature is full of group living animals marked by mood transmission and sensitivity to others. They survive by being in tune with each other. Empathy is found in all mammals, and he gives great examples of that in his new book. You're familiar, I know, many of you, with the work that he has done. He's a psychology professor at Emory University with a PhD in biology. He's the author of several books, including Chimpanzee Politics and Our Inner Ape. He is the director of the Living Link Center at the Yerkes National Primate Research Center in Atlanta. He was ranked among the world's 100 most influential people by Time Magazine in 2007. And he probably still is among the most 100 most influential people in the United States. He's with us. We're going to take phone calls for him. We always do this, and I'm sure we'll have many calls. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you would like to send us an email, feel free to do that. That is talk@wpr.org. Hello, Franz. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Hi, nice with you being there.
Yeah, great pleasure to have you here. I love this book. It's a compilation of all these stories, but it has also got this wider perspective on the world. Do you think that we are, to start off with a grand question here, entering an era in which we're going to be more aware of that peaceful side of our nature instead of a warlike side of our nature?
Well, it's not so much war and peace, although you would hope that that's also true. But it's more that I think society is fed up with greed. You know, greed was good for 30 years and then was celebrated, and we've seen what that has done. It's not so good. And so there is actually a sort of atmosphere now, like we need to shift the orientation of society. And for example, that's part of the healthcare debate. That was part of the Sotomayor debate. That is part of the current debate on greener living and so on. And I think people are ready for a different perspective than just greed and capitalism and competition.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit more about greed and how we see that in the animal world. You note in the book many instances of animals who, when offered food, may sometimes somewhat reluctantly share with others in their family or in their close group, but that there is a lot of sharing that goes on. We don't tend to, other mammals don't tend to hoard things, do they, just for themselves?
Well, there's a recent series of experiments, one of them done by us, which I will describe, but there's several studies now that show that the primates and other animals actually care about the welfare of others. They're not just in it for selfish reasons. And so, for example, we did a little experiment with monkeys where they had a choice. They could choose an option where they would get food for themselves, or they would choose an option where not only they themselves got food, but their partner who was sitting next to them also got food. And generally, they prefer the option that gives both of them food. Now, it doesn't cost them anything to do that, but at least it shows that they feel that if food goes to their neighbor, that's a good thing, actually. And there's several of these studies now that indicate what we call pro-social tendencies or a certain concern about the welfare of others in other primates.
Mm-hmm. And tell us this story. You told it last time, but I love this story, that sometimes we have these incredible acts of kindness that are interspecies acts of kindness.
Well, there are many. There's actually the most recent one was a beluga whale in China. There are stories like this almost every month in the newspapers.
Yeah.
This was in China where a zoo had the silly idea of having people dive in ice-cold water with diving equipment and then see how long they could stay in that water. And a young woman who did that at the zoo there, she got into deep trouble and she couldn't breathe anymore. And this was in water in which there were beluga whales, and one of the whales came up to her and picked her up very gently, almost like a big dog picks up a puppy or something, picked her up and moved her to the surface of the water where she could breathe and was rescued by others. And that kind of acts are actually quite common, and these show these altruistic tendencies in some of the mammals, especially the smarter mammals. They show that kind of behavior.
Uh-huh. And what are the smarter mammals? You're studying elephants, I know.
Yeah,
now.
You have large-brained mammals like elephants and dolphins and apes. And apes are, for example, considerably more intelligent, I think, than monkeys. And apes show much more complex forms of altruism. So to give another example, I give many examples in the book, up to the point that I feel is becoming almost repetitive because there's so many of them. So this is a case that happened at a Swedish zoo, at which a juvenile chimpanzee got caught in some big ropes and had two ropes around the neck and was choking and was going to die. And the alpha male of the group came up to the juvenile, picked him up with one arm, so lifted, sort of took the pressure off the ropes. And then with the other hand, he unwrapped the ropes and so freed the juvenile and set him free. Now, that's what I call targeted helping or insightful helping. And that's what you find in the more intelligent animals. It's not just a helping response or being distressed, which many animals have, but they also have a sort of insight of what is best for this individual, what is the best way of helping him.
Uh-huh. And you've told this one before many times, but I love the story of, I can't remember if it was a bonobo or an ape who rescued the bird. And it's just such a touching story, and it's fairly elaborate.
Well, I've found a different story that relates to it. The story of the bonobo is a bonobo who rescued a bird who was stunned by flying against glass and then took it to a high point and tried to set it free, tried to make it fly, basically. But then recently I heard a story from the zoo where I used to work in the Netherlands, where the chimpanzees live on a very large island, and the island, the moat around the island is populated by many animals. And there are ducks in there. And so a bunch of ducklings had walked onto the island, and the juvenile chimps were playing with them, but much too roughly, and they were almost killing them. And a high-ranking male scattered the young chimps, and all these ducklings were running back to the water, and one of them stayed behind and was not so good at running, I suppose. And he went up to that young duckling and flipped it with his hand into the water, which I found a very interesting story, because he sort of connected the duckling with water, I suppose, and thought that flipping it into the water was the best thing to do for it, which is probably true for a duckling.
Isn't that something? It's just, and so I guess it's sort of built into us, this act of kindness, these acts of kindness. They're hardwired because of evolutionary trends, right? It's hardwired into us?
Yeah, so the main point of my book is to see, first of all, where do we find empathy? Not just helping actions, but the process of empathy is that you are emotionally affected by somebody else. Now, that's a very general process that has been discovered in mice, for example, recently. There are several studies on rodents. So that's a very old mammalian characteristic, is to be emotionally affected by others. And then I'm interested in how complex can this get? Because obviously in some animals it gets much more complicated than just being emotionally affected. You try to figure out what's going on with the other, or you try to help the other. And then my other interest is, of course, what does this mean for society? If human society is based purely on greed and competition, as some people would argue, then you're sort of ignoring this very basic tendency that we have of relating to others. And I think that's what's happened over the last 30 years, is that we've sort of neglected the common good, we have neglected solidarity, we've neglected empathy. And recently when President Obama said, if we get a new judge like Sotomayor, the judge needs to have empathy, there was an outcry in the country. There were people who said, why would a judge need empathy? Well, I think a judge does need certain feelings about the human species and human society. And that's a very important part of being a judge, I think.
Yeah. And what about animals whose brains aren't quite as big? You also tell some remarkable observances about dogs and, as you say, mice and even fish and birds who mm-hmm. do travel in groups to take care of each other.
Well, fish don't have a lot of helping behavior. So many animals have herding behavior, which is related, sort of related, in that they like to synchronize and they like to do things together, and this is very important for their survival. But they don't have necessarily the emotional connectedness that I think is typically for mammals. And I think it does exist in birds, but there's actually for birds, there's very little systematic study. There's many studies on mammals, but very little on birds.
Mm-hmm. What about dogs? I love dogs.
Dogs have plentiful. Dogs are highly social, and dogs have empathic reactions and have even also the fairness reactions that I also write about, is that they don't like unfair treatment, but they have empathic reactions, and everyone who has a dog knows that they respond. There's actually a funny story about this. There's a scientist who lives in Wisconsin, Zahn Wachsler, Carolyn Zahn Wachsler, who has studied empathy in children for many years. And one of the experiments that she does is she asks a family member to act distressed, to start crying and coughing and whatever. And then she measures what the children in the family do. And she found that very young children, already one-year-old children, they respond with a sort of empathic reaction. They walk up to this person, they touch the person, and so on. But in the same study, she found, and this was not her intention at all, this was not what she was looking for, but she found that the pets in the home did the same thing. And mammalian pets. I don't think a turtle or an iguana would do this kind of stuff.
Right.
But a dog or a cat will also show concern for the person. And so her reasoning was that if we call this empathy in a young child, why would we not call this empathy in a dog or cat? And so it is interesting that these responses are clearly present in the mammals that we take into our homes.
Yeah. I was struck by some of the stories, and these are just, you know, standout stories of the dogs who have, so their master or mistress has passed away, and they show up for them, you know, sometimes going to a train station, sitting at the train, waiting and for them to get off the train, and they're no longer with us, but the dog has shown up for something like 10 years?
Yeah, these are actually, I would not necessarily call this empathy. These are cases of attachment, emotional attachment, which, of course, in certain animals, or in birds, for example, very developed, because birds are pair bonding, and so they get very attached to their partner. And in this case, these are stories of the one case that I describe is a dog in Japan, whose owner always arrived at a certain time at the train station, and the dog would go and meet him there. But when the owner died, the dog for 10 years kept coming at the same time to the train station and waited there. And people were so moved by it that when the dog died, they erected a little statue for him next to the train station and actually named the exit of the train station after the dog.
Oh, that makes me almost want to cry. What a story that is. And they also become, and I'm wondering where this comes from and what the depth of it is. You tell of animals who have lost, you know, members of their family and carry the dead member of the family around until the body almost decomposes, that there must be, is it grief they're feeling? What is that?
Yeah, that's actually quite typical for many mammals.
Really?
Because many mammals, of course, the female is very attached to her offspring. That's also a physiological attachment. She has physiological responses if the offspring doesn't nurse anymore because it has died. And so there's a lot more to it than just, let's say, an awareness of death. There's also a physiological component to it. And many mammalian females have that kind of attachment, and in some it lasts longer than in others. And, for example, in apes it's quite common that if a baby dies, that the mother keeps dragging it around until it basically falls apart. And it basically means that she cannot let go. It's probably a very adaptive response because, if a mother mammal would drop her offspring at each occasion that it's not in a good shape anymore, she would lose a lot of offspring. So she needs to hang on to them. Of course, when they're dead, there's no point to it. But when they are sickly, she also needs to hang on to them because there's still a chance that they may survive.
Mm-hmm. So is there then a difference in the amount of empathy shown by female mammals and male mammals.
Yeah, my idea is that the origin of empathy is in maternal care. And maternal care is obligatory in the mammals. And a female needs to respond right away to the emotions of her offspring. If her offspring are hungry or in danger or they're cold or they're lost, and they give lost calls. Mammals have calls for that, actually, all mammals. So she needs to respond right away, otherwise she may lose her offspring. And so there's a high selection pressure, that there's a high survival value, let's say, to emotional responsiveness in females to her offspring. Now, from there, you can easily see how that is related to empathy. And from there, it can expand to other relationships, not just between mother and offspring, but also between mother and other females or between males. And I think that's also the origin of the gender difference that we see in empathy. Empathy is stronger, more strongly developed in girls than in boys. And actually, this in humans, this starts already on day one. On day one, girl babies cry more when they hear another baby cry than boy babies do. And so it's not, some people think it's enculturated, but I think it's deeply ingrained that an empathy response is more easily triggered in females than in males.
Oh, that's interesting. And what about this response of being so incredibly sad that you die when your partner dies, when you have examples of that in the book? Is that extreme or not?
Yeah, that happens. It happens also in humans, you know, that when a partner dies, the surviving one has a higher risk of dying in the at least for 6 months, there's an increased risk of dying of heart attack or cancer or whatever. And so in animals, yes, I know cases of my own experience, and I know many other people, especially in birds, this is common because birds are so strongly pair-bonded that they can't stand the loss of a partner, and they're very stressed out about it. And I've lost a bird that way. I had two birds, jackdaws, which are sort of crows, small crows, which were pair-bonded, and when one partner escaped from the aviary because of children who had been playing with it, I think, the male who was left behind for 2 weeks, he did nothing. He didn't eat, he didn't drink. He only called and looked at the sky,
aww,
and then he died.
Aww. Let's take phone calls for Franz. Franz DeWall is our guest. His new book is The Age of Empathy, Nature's Lessons for a Kinder Society. He was born in the Netherlands, and he lives and works in Atlanta, Georgia. He's done a great deal of work in Madison, too, at the University of Wisconsin. He is one of the best-known primatologists in the world. He is a professor of psychology and director of the Living Links Center at the Yerkes National Primate Research Center at Emory University. Has been elected to the National Academy of Sciences and the Royal Dutch Academy of Sciences. We have a couple lines open if you'd like to join the conversation. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Franz DeWall is our guest. His new book is The Age of Empathy, Nature's Lessons for a Kinder Society. His message in the book, there are many, but that empathy really is an ancient trait. It is not limited to us and is a highly adaptive capacity that has served many other species before us. He says that many animal lovers know this, he's sure, but in academic and political discourse, it's often forgotten that human empathy is at the core of what we are. Let's go to phone calls now. We start with Rich from Rhinelander. Hi, Rich.
Hi, I'm really enjoying the program. Thank you. It seems to me the problem of human empathy for me is to be able to extend it beyond my immediate group to larger purposes, beyond affinity or solidarity to the wider world. I'm thinking of how astounded I was when I read the Diary of Anne Frank, and she's able to say something like, despite everything, I still think people are really good at heart.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm looking for situations like I was listening earlier today about the Israelis and the Palestinians, and wondering what's the trick to getting us human primates to extend empathy widely so that we see every father as a dad, every mother as a mom, mm-hmm, and that our concerns are to our own, and if the doctor question. I'm nominating him for a Nobel Peace.
It's a wonderful question. Thank you, Rich.
Yeah, I think empathy cannot be unlimited. So empathy is always filtered and subject to constraints. Because if you were to empathize with everybody in the world equally, you would have no life, and emotionally you would basically drown. You have to measure it. And so empathy is always aroused more for the in-group than the out-group. This is even true in some of the experiments on mice that have been reported, is that mice have an emotional response to the emotions of mice that they know, but not to mice that they don't know. And so that bias is all the way found in all sorts of animals, is that the closer the partners are, the more similar they are, the stronger the empathy response. And so the challenge for our current society, because we don't live in these small groups anymore that we came from, a group of 100 or a group of 200, where you have families and you know everybody. We now live in these large, huge societies where we have cities with 10 million people. That's not a normal situation for us, but we still have the same empathy responses. But we're reaching a limit of what we can do with them. And I do feel, for example, that the Palestinian-Israeli conflict is interesting. There was a minister of, I think it was a minister of justice, Joseph Lapin, I believe was his name, who one time created an outrage in his country of Israel by saying that on TV he had seen a Palestinian woman whose house had been destroyed by Israeli bombs, and he was very upset about it, and he thought, if that were my grandmother, I would be crying now, and things like that. And the Israelis got so angry at him because he was showing empathy for the enemy, basically. And he shouldn't be doing that. And Anne Frank did the same thing. And so there are people who are capable of showing empathy even for the out-group, even if the out-group is opposed to you. And this is truly remarkable. And I think one of the things that we need in a world today that is so large and so complex is an expansion of the range of empathy, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. I'm reminded, as you were telling that story of the, I'm sure you know it, the Christmas truce in World War I, where the Germans and the British put down and celebrated Christmas together with Christmas trees and songs. And I always thought after I heard that story, how could they not have continued it? Why would they had such a wonderful time with each other and treated each other as human beings? Why didn't they forever do that?
Well, it is true. I think that war, especially on close range, it's very unnatural for humans to kill humans that they don't know at close range. And there's an interesting book by David Grossman on how few Americans actually fired shots at the enemy during World War II, and how few Americans fired shots at the enemy during the Vietnam War, is that soldiers are actually extremely reluctant and are very upset when they actually kill enemy soldiers. And that's one of the reasons we have so many cases of PTSD, because people come back totally traumatized, because killing mm-hmm. at a range where you can see the enemy mm-hmm. is actually very counter natural for humans.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Rich, so much for your call. Let's go next to Mike from Madison. Hello, Mike.
Hi. I wanted to thank for the last caller. That was a great question that led into a lot.
Yes, it was.
I had a quick question. My father passed away about 4 years ago, and my mother has never quite been the same. And I think a lot of that has been due to her empathetic response. And I'm curious, after a spouse dies, does the person become more empathetic or less?
Oh, I have no idea about that, because I'm not a human psychologist, so to speak. I do think that what I read in the reports, that there's an increased risk of dying right after you lose a spouse, is related to the fact that you become less careful about your own life, in the sense that people actually have more accidents and watch themselves less carefully. And so let's say their attachment to their own life is weakened by the loss of a spouse. But how it affects the emotions, I do think it creates a stress response, and so it affects probably your immune system also. But I'm not a psychologist of human affairs, and so I don't know exactly what happens to people who lose their spouse.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mike, very much for your call. And going back to those babies for a moment, when you talked about girl babies crying more when they heard other babies, If you take that girl baby, though, and I know there are instances of this in your book, and give that baby no nurturing, no empathy. In other words, you need to show empathy and nurture with empathy, or you get a being that seems less than human almost.
You mean that you can affect how a boy or girl grows up,
right,
in terms of empathy?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure you can. So none of this, if you say, for example, that empathy is an instinct or that empathy is inborn and hardwired in the human species, which I believe, none of that excludes the fact that culture and education will have a major effect on how it develops. And so a parent who instills empathy and teaches their children you need to share your toys with other children or things, or consider the feelings of other children, all of that has an effect, I'm sure.
Yeah. Let's go next to Seal from Gurnee, Illinois. Hi, Seal.
Hi. I'm really enjoying this program. I have a story of empathy in a dog. I had a dachshund, and she gave birth to 8 puppies. And one of our neighbors adopted one of the puppies, and the rest went off to other people. And so those two, my dog, Kukin, and the puppy played together for about a year and a half, because they lived right next door. Then the neighbors moved away about 10 or 12 miles. And about a year later, our dog howled one night, just howled all night long. And there was nothing we could do to console her. We let her out. We gave her water. I put her in my bed with me. Nothing solved it. And the next day, the old neighbor called and said that puppy had died.
Oh, my gosh.
Huh. Well, I don't know how that was communicated. So I don't know how that works.
Huh.
You hear sometimes that kind of stories, and there's no experimental evidence that dogs can communicate something like that over a distance. But, I don't know what to say about that.
Thanks. Well, yeah, I'm sorry.
I just have to add one other thing. She was such an intuitive dog that I was a teenager, and I would pretend that I was going to school because then she wouldn't run around and want to go out with me. And then other days, I would consciously think the opposite, but I was going out to play. And then she would run around and act like she wanted to go out. Anyway, thank you so much for the program. I really enjoy it.
Good. Thank you. Thanks very much for your call. Ben is next from Mequon. Hi, Ben.
Morning. Very good program. Subject matter is covering material that I've contemplated for a long time. My comment is, having grown up Catholic and gone to Catholic grade school, we were always taught that these are just dumb animals that don't have any intelligence. And I've always questioned that type of teaching. And I guess the point I'm trying to make is, what religion plays in the mm-hmm. role of how we look at animals.
Yeah, it's been a tension for a long time. That's a good point.
Yeah, well, the Christian religion has given the human a soul, and animals, unfortunately, have no soul. And so it's partly because if you are agriculturists, you need to be able to exploit animals, I suppose, and to justify that. I think that was maybe part of the motivation, but I think also partly because of the history of Christianity, because it came out of a desert religion, and in the desert you have very few animals that look like you. And so religions like the Eastern religions, like Buddhism and Hinduism, in countries where there are primates, other primates to look at, they have not created that very sharp dividing line between the human and other animals. And that's, I think, partly because they were surrounded by animals that look a lot like us, and so that connection between us and animals was more easily made. And Christianity created a gap between the two, which then, of course, when Darwin came along and other biologists saying that we derive from other animals and that we are connected to other animals in an evolutionary sense, that upset a lot of people, because they were raised in the belief that we are totally separate. So I think it's a Christian thing. It's not necessarily a Catholic thing. And it relates, I think, to the fact that animals close to us or similar to us were not present when these religions originated.
Hmm.
And yet you have to question, you have to think about what would heaven be. It wouldn't be much of a heaven if you didn't have all the great dogs you ever had. Right?
I don't know, yeah.
Yeah, but it wouldn't be much of a place. But it's also kept, those beliefs, has kept us from doing the kind of intense work that you've done for a number of years. Your field of study has flourished recently because we don't have those kinds of preconceptions about animals anymore, right?
Yeah, the boundaries are actually sort of breaking down gradually, is that... there was a time, like let's say 30 years ago, if you would compare humans with animals and say, let's say humans show jealousy and dogs show jealousy and these are similar responses, you would be stoned to death basically because that would be sacrilegious to say something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And we are not like that anymore. There's a much greater openness in society to consider that the emotions and the psychological complexity of humans and animals are actually very similar in a way.
Let's go next. Thank you, Ben, for your call. We go next to Pat from Madison. Hi, Pat.
Hi. I've been wanting to talk about this topic for a long time, and I just came on your radio show. I used to have a small parrot. Well, he was larger than robins and stuff, but he was small for a parrot, who got loose. And when we were trying to catch him, he was trying to get back to me, but he couldn't figure out. He'd never flown outside of the house before, so he didn't know how to get down, you know. And he was up in an apple tree, and I was calling to him, and he was calling back. And there were two robins in the apple tree, and they would hop up toward him and then hop down the branches, each one going an easy way to get down to me. And they would come down with so that I was close enough I could touch them. And then he'd get all excited, and he didn't know what to do. And then they'd hop back up to him, and they'd hop back down. And it was clear that they were showing him how to get to me.
Huh.
And when he tried to do it, of course, because he wasn't experienced outside, he got excited, and he flew off. And he was gone for 3 days, and we kept having little encounters like this where I would get very close to him, and he would try to get to me, but he didn't know how to do what he needed to do. And a couple of other times, wild birds acted like, you know, we're trying to figure out how to show you what to do, you know? but not as much as those birds did. And I was really quite impressed, and I've told people about that before, and I've said, you know, I really think that they understood what he needed, and that he couldn't figure it out, and they were trying to show him, this is how you get to your person, to your safety. And mostly I've been told I was full of bugs. So it's nice to have a chance to tell it to somebody finally.
You're telling it to a lot of people, Pat. So were her friends right? Was she full of bugs, or what was that all about?
I would have to see it to believe it, so to speak. That's always, you have to see the dynamics of how these things go. But it is true that, and this is sort of remarkable, is that many birds, when they're young or when they're inexperienced with flying, they have an easier time flying than landing. So this is actually, I find it always amusing to watch in birds who are young and get out of the nest, is that they're much better at flying away than landing, and they land usually on their noses or in some very odd way. And so this bird was probably afraid of descending because he didn't know how to do that.
Hmm. Let me ask you, because I know that there's an underlying theme to the book about societies and kindness and war and peace and all of that, but you talk about these social instincts and you ask this huge question, which I want you to elaborate on. What is it that makes us care about the behavior of others or about others, period? Moral judgment obviously goes further than this, but an interest in others is fundamental. Where would human morality be without it? It is the bedrock upon which everything else is constructed.
Yeah, so I think in a society as large as, let's say, the American society, where you have millions of people, you're still driven to some degree by empathy in many of your decisions. So, for example, the decision to abolish slavery was partly motivated by empathy. Lincoln had, for example, seen shackled slaves, and Lincoln was a very empathic person, and he wrote to friends that this caused him great misery that he had seen this and that he didn't like to see this kind of thing. And so even though the abolishment of slavery, of course, also has to do with human rights and equality between humans, but empathy enters into that kind of decision. The healthcare debate is another interesting debate where, of course, the decision to improve your healthcare system is not necessarily based purely on empathy. It has also to do with economic and political considerations, and it has to do with the common good and solidarity among people. But empathy enters in there. And if we hear of a family who has lost everything because of the insurance company kicking them out or something like that, we feel empathy with that, and we think, well, this could also happen to us, and so then the selfish motives enter. But empathy is part of that equation. And so in all the decisions we take in society, these decisions are not purely made on the basis of money or politics. They're also made on the basis of our sense of solidarity with others, which used to be called fellow feeling by the older politicians in the times of Lincoln. So they spoke of fellow feeling as the bedrock of society. And I think that's still the case. And we have lived through a time, actually basically since Reagan, we've lived through a time where this kind of feeling was poo-pooed, like, who needs empathy and sympathy and solidarity if we can solve all the problems with market forces?
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm arguing in my book is you cannot solve all the problems in the world with market forces. You have to consider that you are in this together and that you're one society and that you do have a common good that you should worry about.
And what about those, though, who seem oblivious to the common good? You write about some private jet company which has been set up since Hurricane Katrina. So you can, if you find yourself in a hurricane, you know, who cares about the other person? But you'll get out of town in a hurry because you got your ticket on a private jet.
Yeah, that's a sort of everyone for himself type of attitude that has been promoted over the last 30 years. And I think it's a disaster. And this happened with Katrina. And Katrina affected me more than normal, I think, partly because I'm a Dutchman by origin. And for us, dikes are sacred. No one messes with a dike because half of the Netherlands is below the ocean surface. And so we are very careful with this. And when I saw the levees in New Orleans and the recently repaired levees in New Orleans, I laughed at it because it's a joke. They're not serious. And so why in a big, rich country like the United States, why don't you take a city like New Orleans serious? Why don't you want to protect them? And then there's all sorts of arguments that people give, and one of them is that they shouldn't be living there or something like that. So there's a lot of selfish reasons why people don't sort of show the solidarity that I think they should be showing with people in a place that is in danger.
Yeah. Let's welcome more phone calls. Our guest this hour on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio is Franz de Waal. He's the author most recently of The Age of Empathy, Nature's Lessons for a Kinder Society. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. And I just have one more announcement for you. You know, we've got this pledge drive that's coming up, and we'll be able to cut some days off this drive. It's for every 700 people who pledge, we'll cut a day off. And we're really close to the first 700. We're at 652 right now, which means that we'll have another whole day to have full hour-long conversations like this one. So go to WPR.org to donate now and get some days off the pledge drive. I'm for that. I'm Kathleen Dunn, back with Franz de Waal in just a moment. One line is open if you want to take it. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We return to phone calls now for Franz de Waal. Mike from Brookfield. Hi, Mike.
Good morning, Kathleen. Good morning to your guest. This is a fascinating topic since the political debate has gotten so rancorous, and I've often thought, where does the reactionary forces come from? And it seems to me like it's a hardwired reptilian brain reaction that if you threaten people and they fear survival or food, hunger, shelter, and whatever animal drives we have are more basic than the higher level thinking of rationality and you know, debate. And I'm wondering what your guests might think about the solution to this situation now, where fear tends to drive anger, and anger tends to be very caustic and cancerous because it can be contagious. And the only solution to anger is basically to rise above it and understand where the anger is coming from, and hopefully find a solution for it.
That's a really good point, Franz.
Well, I cannot solve that problem so easily. So what I'm, one of the things that I'm reacting to is that the argument for a society based on, in let's say, individual rights and competition and a neglect of solidarity and common good, the argument is often based actually on biology, and I'm a biologist, and so to that point I can argue. And so people will say, for example, and this is basically a social Darwinist argument, they will say, we are all individuals, we fight for ourselves and our immediate family, and if we do well, that is fine, and if others don't do so well, that's fine too, as long as we get paid for the work that we do, and so on. And so they have a very individualistic perspective, and they don't think about the larger society in which they live. And they base that on nature. They say, well, look at nature. Nature is struggle for survival, and that's how things operate in nature, and there's competition plentiful there, and that's how we need to, what we need to mimic in our society. And that's where I can make an argument, and I can say, well, if that's your image of nature, it's a wrong image, because there's many animals, tons of them actually, who live by cooperating with each other. There's many animals like wolves and killer whales and primates and elephants and so on. There are many animals who live through cooperation, and so they do care about each other because they depend on each other. And so this whole image that we need to mimic the competition of nature is a false image, which is not based on real Darwinism and it's not based on real biology.
Could you tell me a more? The last time you were with us, you talked about the fact that you were going to spend a lot more time working with elephants.
Mm-hmm.
What have you learned, Franz?
Well, we did the mirror test with elephants. I don't know if you've heard about that, but we tested some elephants at the Bronx Zoo to mm-hmm. see if they recognize themselves in a mirror, and actually one of the elephants did, and this is quite spectacular because there's very few animals who have that capacity. Only dolphins and apes and elephants have that capacity. And then I have a student, his name is Josh Plotnick, who moved to Thailand and started doing studies of elephants, including empathic responses and including cooperation, because we know much less about elephants than we know about most other animals. Everyone knows that elephants are sensitive and intelligent, but that's actually based mostly on anecdotes. It's not based on systematic studies. And part of the reason is that it's impossible, almost impossible to work with these animals. Who's going to set up an elephant laboratory at the University of Wisconsin? It's not going to happen anytime soon. You can right. imagine why that is. And so they're very dangerous to work with, very hard to work with. And so in Thailand, where every elephant has a mahout, every elephant has someone who is a leader and a guide of the elephant, you can actually set up tests, and that's what we're doing with the help of Thai people to test these elephants on their intelligence and their emotions and so on.
Hmm. Let's go next to Frank from Green Bay. Hello, Frank. Hello, Frank. Call us back, Frank. Margaret, my favorite name in the world, from Sun Prairie. Hello, Margaret.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. First of all, I'd like to say that I think dogs have taught us to be empathetic, but that's another statement. But I want to talk about meat eaters, and if we had to watch ourselves kill the animal, would there be more vegetarians around?
If we had to watch ourselves kill the animals?
Right.
I don't know. I think humans have a long history of eating meat, and actually our close relatives, the chimpanzees, are also pretty big on eating meat. I'm not saying we're necessarily carnivores. I think we're omnivores. But meat eating is something that we have done for a very long time, and according to some, of course, our brain expansion is partly related to the meat intake that we got out of that. Which is particularly nutritious in certain domains. So I don't think meat eating is necessarily unnatural for the human species, and we've been hunting as far as we can remember.
Mm-hmm. You're studying elephants. You've done years and years of work with chimpanzees, bonobos, apes. Is there another species that really has captured your attention, Franz, because you think there are great possibilities of learning something substantial about them that will alter the course of world history in some way? Something we haven't looked at as closely as we should.
Oh, I think that in the cetaceans, there are many species that we know little about. You know, for example, the dolphins, of course, we can study both in the field, as people do, and in captivity. But there are cetaceans like sperm whales, you're never going to find them in captivity because they're too big. And in the wild, it's very hard to keep up with them, and it's very hard to watch them. And all you get to see is sometimes they come to the surface, and it's very hard to study these animals. And so I think many of these marine mammals are understudied because it's so almost impossible to get the data on them. And I think they're truly remarkable animals. Everything we know about them until now indicates that some of them are truly remarkable intellects, so to speak, but we know so little about them.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Kathleen next from La Crosse. Hi, Kathleen.
Good morning. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
Good. I have a question for Dr. DeWalls. I've seen this in humans, but I'm wondering if this happens with animals. And it kind of goes toward empathy. I've seen with humans more and more lately in casual contact or non-casual contact, people looking past each other, trying not to make contact, trying not to be involved in each other's lives. And does that occur in the animal world anywhere?
Yeah, I think in humans that may happen because we are in such large societies where we would not necessarily do that with our immediate family members, I hope. But because we have so many contacts with so many people that we need to shut off some of it. Otherwise, it's going to overwhelm us, I think. And especially, I'm speaking at the moment from New York, where I am, in a city like that. That's what people do, actually. When they walk the streets, they don't look at each other, because if you start saying hello to everybody, you wouldn't have a life. Or actually, New Yorkers may react aggressively to that. And so I think what happens in our large-scale societies is that we become very highly selective. Now, in a small-scale society, which is where we probably come from, our ancestors probably lived in groups of 100, maybe 200, you couldn't do that. I don't think you could walk by somebody without acknowledging their presence. And so that's very different. And I think all of this is an adaptation that we are developing towards living in big cities.
Okay. Do you see that in the animal world at all? Or is it
no, because the animals that I work with are always animals who live in a group where they know everybody. Now, if you had a herd of animals like wildebeest or a large, a couple of thousand of them, where you cannot recognize everyone, things may break down in that regard. So, for example, there is data on monkey groups in Japan who have been fed so much food by tourists, because there are certain places where the tourists can feed them, that the monkey groups have been expanding to an extraordinary size. So instead of having a group of 100 monkeys, they have groups of 1,000 monkeys.
Whoa!
Now, if you have a group of 1,000 monkeys, not all monkeys know each other anymore. And the hierarchy falls apart. So instead of having a strict hierarchy and a good affiliative network, as it is called, it starts to fall apart. And maybe in that kind of societies, if you would study them, you would see the same sort of thing, where they walk past each other without seeing each other, basically.
Sure. Well, thank you very much. I'm a great admirer of your work.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kathleen, for your call. David from Dubuque. Hi, David.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks so much for this wonderful program.
Sure.
And I got kind of a strange question here. I was wondering if we've lost our empathy to Mother Nature with all the things that human beings are doing now, the climate change. Have we somehow lost an empathy to the balance of nature?
Yeah, I'm not sure that would be based on empathy. Because empathy, for me, is a bodily connection between individuals that relates to emotions and motor patterns and facial expressions. And out of that grows a connection also at a sort of intellectual level between individuals. So towards nature in general, or towards a landscape, or towards the sky, I'm not sure that I would use the word empathy. But with nature, I would more use the word, do we recognize the value of nature, or don't we recognize the value of nature? And some people do, and some people think they can ignore it, but I think they do it at their peril.
Thank you so much for the call. Well, it's always a treat to have you on, Franz DeWall. Thank you so much for the latest book and for being with us this hour.
You're welcome.
Our guest this hour, Franz de Waal. His book is The Age of Empathy, Nature's Lessons for a Kinder Society. He's written a number of other books and has joined us in conversations when those books have been released. He's done a lot of work. The thing I remember his recommending, and then I went and did it, was, the Milwaukee County Zoo has a huge selection of bonobos, one of the biggest in the whole world, which are fascinating. And he spent a great deal of time watching them and talking about them. So, and he's done a lot of work at the University of Wisconsin-Madison as well. He now works, he's from the Netherlands and is a biologist living and working in Atlanta, Georgia. He is a professor of psychology and director of the Living Link Center at the Yerkes National Primate Research Center at Emory University, selected by Time Magazine as one of the world's 100 most influential people in 2007. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this great show. Thanks to John Treader for on-air production. And thanks to you, everybody, for your marvelous calls. I'll be with you again on Monday at 9 for All Things Political. So until then, keep listening. This is the Ideas Network.